Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 82 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful and silly hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing okay, Weird. How you doing?
That's just goofy.
Silly, goofy.
Yeah, it's all different sides of the same coin. We have a good time doing this. That's what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Negative.
I put up with you. No, not really.
We're supposed to get a ton of snow, Aaron, because you know what? By the time you're hearing this, it's almost Christmas.
So have you... I think you'd used it last year. The birthday present that I got you was a little duck maker, and you could make it with snow. And I believe you said you and your daughter took it out and you made little snow duckies and put them on your front lawn or something. Have you had a chance to do that yet?
Oh, God. Not this. We got the only big snow that we got was actually when we were in the Caribbean. So my parents, my mom called and she was like, "How's the weather down there?" And I said, "Well, it was really nice yesterday because it was overcast, but today it's clear and really the sun is intense. Like it's a little bit unpleasant to be out of the shade right now. We wish the clouds would come back." And she goes, "There is 11 inches of snow in your driveway, and we're shoveling it for you. I'm so sorry, the sun is so hot."
Wait, crave some more, Weird.
Oh no, you're at an all-inclusive resort and you're having breakfast beers. We're shoveling snow with your daughter.
Yeah, you were drinking some rum in what looked like an outdoor cabana.
That was actually the veranda
veranda. My apologies.
That's what I was. We actually looked up the definition, and I guess technically, because it was a fully enclosed balcony, it was technically a veranda. But I just called it that just to be snooty. But yes, I had a very good time drinking a little tiny bottle of rum. Looking out at the I think it's technically the North Atlantic, not the Caribbean Ocean, but I don't know. One of the locals referred to it as the Caribbean, so I don't know. It's all the same salt water.
So how much alcohol did you end up bringing back?
I think I peed it all out before we got to the United States.
Well, at least you weren't trying to smuggle it in inside your belly.
Yeah, no. My wife said, "So what is the customs form and all that?" And I'm like, "This is a 350 milliliter bottle. It's like a six pack of beer. I don't think it's going to last that long. I want a couple of stiff belts right now. So I don't see the point in bringing this home." Plus, I enjoyed the challenge. Challenge accepted.
You sure you don't want to become a professional alcoholic? Because I think you could. You've got the chops.
Yeah. No, I lose my nerve when I start getting into like the dangerous territories. Unfortunately, I know several professional alcoholics, and yeah, I can't keep up with them. I even know a few amateur alcoholics, and I can't keep up with them. So how is your Christmas season going, Aaron?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I actually got the most wonderful and unexpected Christmas present today.
Well, so what'd you get, Aaron?
So first I got a bit of a fright because yesterday it's been a heck of a week. Again, I'll spare the details, but, I got a notification on YouTube that my sister had subscribed to my channel, and this was a surprise and a shock because, well, I'm not out to my sister. I'm not out to my family at all for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to get into it. Let's just say that every time I explain it to people, they go, "Yeah, that makes sense." And so she didn't just find my channel. She subscribed to it. And I'm going, "Oh, crap. Okay, this could get really sporty really quickly." Because I don't know how she's going to react, and I don't know how she's going to, you know, if she's going to tell my parents or what. And I called her phone and she didn't answer. And I sent her a quick text saying something like, you know, hey, are you there? Can we talk? And didn't get a response. And I'm starting to panic at this point. But then I sent her an email saying an email from my family account rather than my Aaron Paulette account, just saying something like, hey, I noticed you found my YouTube channel. You probably have questions. I'm happy to answer them. We should talk. And nothing. No response. And just all today, I've just been dreading. Oh, God, my life is going to be ruined. And so right as I'm getting to walk the dogs, like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a text from her. And she says, boy, it has been a nonstop day at work today. I meant to message you back, but honestly didn't have time. I'm really not bothered by your queerness. You seem happy. You have a purpose. You are who you are. I'm completely fine with that. And so my reaction was just, oh my God, thank goodness.
I have legitimate tears relief in my eyes, Aaron. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really sweet. And so we went back and forth a little bit. We couldn't actually call because, you know, I'm recording the podcast and she was teaching piano lessons, but we're going to talk later in the week. And it's just best of all possible outcomes. And this is amazing. And so I'm really looking forward to talking to her about this. And it's a massive, first of all, I'm no longer worried. Secondly, oh my God, she accepts me, and that's just fantastic. And so it's really like the best present she's ever gotten me. Maybe one of the best Christmas presents I've had ever. And so, that's fantastic. So I went from having a really rough week and not a great day to, oh my God, this is fantastic. So, yeah, I experienced a roller coaster of emotions over about the past 24 hours.
Well, there. But like a roller coaster, it's wee. That was awesome. Let's not do it again, but that was fun. Maybe there'll be a picture of that point where I have the most dread show up in the lobby. That should be a feature added to your life of just the when things go really, really bad, but then turn out okay. Suddenly you get a snapshot of the this is that moment where the doctor said he found a lump and then 10 minutes later it was like, oh yeah, no, it's nothing.
So weird. I noticed that we don't have a main topic today. Why is that?
Well, it turned out that I actually had a couple of interviews already on tap that I was just, oh, we'll keep those until it just page them out. I don't want to. All right, you know, behind the scenes, yeah, when I set up an interview time with somebody, we usually do a couple of segments worth if they've got stuff to talk about, and I find that's good, but I don't feel like running them all back to back as a general rule because, yeah, it's a variety show. Let's keep things varied. But I realized, oh man, a couple of these really tie in well with current events, so I just thought, you know what? We don't need a main topic. We've got segments that tie into our main topic.
Yeah, especially since as we're getting closer to Christmas, we have people who are doing the family thing or going to different parties. They don't have time to submit segments. And instead of just nagging them mercilessly, we should probably let them off for this 1 month
or year. Or poor Oddball and Panya. They've got the plague right now.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I shouldn't find that funny, but the way you said they have the plague,
that was literally how Oddball said it to me. And so, yeah, no, I tittered as well.
So if you've been paying attention to what's been going on in Virginia, you've probably heard about Second Amendment sanctuary cities and counties. But what is a Second Amendment sanctuary, and what does declaring yourself one mean? Weird interviewed a friend of the show and resident of another kind of sanctuary city, Chris Chang, to find out.
Joining the show once again is, you know him from Top Shot. You know him from his book, Shoot to Win. It is Chris Chang. How you doing, Chris?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So there was a subject matter that we were just talking about before we started recording. And honestly, I don't know a ton about it as firsthand knowledge. Do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, sure thing. So, you know, you and I, we were talking about this concept of a Second Amendment sanctuary, and it's, you know, it's a relatively new tactic and approach that cities and counties around the country are basically declaring themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries, usually through some sort of non-binding resolution. But the concept is that the city or the county is declaring themselves right as a Second Amendment sanctuary, and they will not enforce any gun laws that they deem unconstitutional. And it started as a very small movement, right? We just had, you know, kind of one city here and, you know, another county there. And but, you know, we're now up to 127 cities and counties across the country that have declared themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries. And, you know, what's interesting about the concept is it's a play off of the concept of a sanctuary city, where we're a sanctuary city like San Francisco, where I live, basically has declared ourselves a city that will not work with or comply with federal immigration laws that the city disagrees with. So, you know, you might have heard in the media, right, that these sanctuary cities are, you know, bastions for illegal immigrants and crime. And, you know, unfortunately, there have been many instances where that's true, right, where the city of San Francisco will not cooperate, you know, with ICE. You know, we had a tragic homicide a few years ago. There was a young girl named Katie Steinle. She was, I think, in her 20s and, you know, had her whole life ahead of her. And she was here in San Francisco on vacation with her parents. And they were on one of the piers over the water, and some crazy guy shot her. And from what I remember, you know, he said it was an accident. And he was an illegal immigrant who happened to find the gun. I think he said his story was he found it under a bench. I think it ended up being a law enforcement weapon that just happened to be, you know, stolen / misplaced. But, you know, the point was, you know, this guy, the criminal, the illegal, you know, immigrant who shot her, he's not serving any time. You know, he went through trial, and I don't remember the details around why he wasn't successfully prosecuted, but it just goes to show that, you know, I don't want my city to be a safe haven or refuge for criminals. And I don't care whether you are an illegal immigrant or if you're an American citizen. Like, I don't want my city to be friendly to criminals, right? I don't even look at this through an immigration lens necessarily. It's just, hey, if you're committing crimes, you should be punished for it. You know, this city, my city of San Francisco, we have become so incredibly soft on crime. That within itself is almost a crime. another example, we have recently, our Board of Supervisors passed a law that softens the language we use of those who have been incarcerated. So, you know, you're no longer a felon. You are a former participant in the criminal justice system. I mean, right? It's like all of these watering down and softening of language. And I mean, we're part of this law that changed is we're literally going to be striking the word felon, right, out of the penal code and the way that our public officials refer to felons. I mean, this is ridiculous, right? That we are, and we're reducing, you know, sentences. We're we have a new DA who literally he just won an election, and he said, "I'm not going to prosecute quality of life issues like dealing drugs on the street, like defecating and urinating, you know, in public spaces." And a whole litany of other problems, and so the city is really just just falling apart. But, you know, back to the Second Amendment sanctuary concept, it's a concept I wholeheartedly support. And I think it's a way for the local citizen, right, the local resident to really take power, you know, right, into your own hands and make a very clear and bold statement that your city or your county supports the Second Amendment, and it won't cost you anything other than just a little bit of time to debate and discuss, all right, the measure and pass it in your, you know, in your voting body.
So I got to ask, I mean, how does this, I certainly, you know, disagree with the, you know, sanctuary cities when it comes to, you know, violating laws and softening up on issues like defecating in the streets. I mean, oh my God. But how do you see these secular sanctuary cities? Is it not an issue that's two wrongs not making a right?
You know, I guess one thing is we have to look at tactics, right, that are effective. Look at this concept of sanctuary cities. Well, look, right, like there are cities who have, you know, they are basically flaunting, I would say, their responsibility to arrest and prosecute, you know, illegal immigration. And specifically, it's really about the criminals. I mean, right, if we really drill down into my personal opinion, like, honestly, like, I don't necessarily care if you come to this country illegally, as long as you're coming here for the right reasons, which is for freedom, to get a job, right, to contribute to our economy, and right, build a better life for yourself. But right, there is a very small slice of illegal immigrants who are criminals, who either are coming here to take advantage, right, of the system, or they are dealing drugs, they're gangbangers. And again, I know that's a very small percentage. I mean, that's a percentage, though, that, right, we should have law enforcement at all levels cooperating and taking care of that problem segment. So, you know, on this, right, do two wrongs, you know, not make a right, or do two rights make a wrong, you know, whatever combination you want to put here. We're talking about a constitutional right. The gun ownership is a Second Amendment constitutional right. And it is ironic that we have to, that some cities and counties are having to pass resolutions saying that we will enforce the Constitution.
Yeah.
At a very high level, right? That we will enforce the Constitution, and that shouldn't have to be necessary, right? That it just should sort of be assumed that a city, a county, a state, right, is going to follow the Constitution. But this is where we are.
So now, you said there was over 100 cities and counties that have declared themselves sanctuaries. Do they have an overarching framework where how they declare, or is there a general rule, certain things that they will enforce? I assume certain, you know, criminal activities with firearms, I think we all agree, is not protected by the Second Amendment.
Right. Yeah. So I've seen some different variations, and you know, if your listeners are interested in you know, learning more, yeah, if you just Google Second Amendment sanctuary, you can read a whole bunch of you know, articles on what different the different language, right, that city councils or county you know, boards have passed. I would say the general theme is it's a non-binding resolution, right? There's no actual legal teeth, right, behind it. So it's pretty low risk, right, in terms of, right, there's no legal there's no apparent legal risk. This is usually just a non-binding resolution that does not commit, it doesn't legally commit the city or county to do anything. It's just very much a statement of force and clarity.
I'll just turn around and say that there, obviously we hear about our the immigration sanctuary cities a lot in the news, but also I'm here in Massachusetts, and before Massachusetts got recreational marijuana, they decriminalized small amounts. I believe it was amounts that were under an ounce. And like much of New England, this is not a duty to inform state, so you're not required to present identification to a police officer when when you're just simply stopped and a crime has not been committed. So the big issue that what that leads to was a whole bunch of people. If someone was walking down the sidewalk and they were smoking a joint, the police are going to stop that because that is, you know, technically against the law, and but they weren't. It's not a crime. It's just it's a civil infraction, and so they would say, oh, "Well, that's a civil infraction. What's your name?" And they either wouldn't give their name or give a false name, and this essentially led to several police chiefs in the, especially in the Boston area, saying, look, if you see it, just keep moving on. Unless it looks like there's a big deal going on, do not harass them because it's just not worth our time. And
interesting.
Yeah, I would argue that looking the other way on a law that really doesn't do anything to the people. I mean, the idea is, I mean, essentially they would take the marijuana away and you'd have to pay a fine. And that was all that was to it. Does that cause any problems in the long run of it? And I would argue the same thing goes of the, oh, if you've got a 15 round magazine in your gun and your state says, oh no, 10's only okay. Does that make a difference? If your AR-15 has, doesn't have a pinned flash hide or a pinned muzzle brake on it, does that make a difference if you're in a state that has a rule such as that? So I did play a little devil's advocate, but overall I do see the validity on that, and note that, yeah, no, it is the Second Amendment, and the Second Amendment comes first as far as how our laws are enforced. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Chris. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed myself.
I mean, I've really been thinking about this interview because we did it like a month ago, and I legitimately, all that, like, what is a Second Amendment sanctuary city? That was a legitimate question. He was saying, yeah, I want to talk about sanctuary cities. And I'm like, okay. I mean, why don't you take us away, Chris? Because I really don't know much about these. And now, as this nonsense is falling out in Virginia, suddenly it's becoming all so clear.
Yeah, and it's really amazing how quickly it's happened in Virginia. I've got a webpage here, Gun Rights Watch, and the article was published Sunday, November 24th, but they keep updating it. And so they've got a map now of Second Amendment sanctuary counties in Virginia. It's accurate as of the 14th, so that would be... We're recording this on Monday the 16th, so that would be Saturday. And I'm looking at it, and I don't know the numbers, but it looks like an easy 85% to 90% of all the counties in Virginia are some degree of Second Amendment sanctuary cities, with others that are in progress. And it's just really amazing, this, not just the groundswell, but how quickly it has happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I just pulled up the map, and of course it'll be in the show notes, and wow. I mean, it is just a huge swath of the state, and that makes it very interesting. I mean, I played the devil's advocate with Chris, but now that I've been looking at it from the side of what's happening in Virginia. First up, a lot of the police chiefs and sheriffs who have been making these declarations, they're doing it on constitutional grounds, which I gotta say, I mean, it's suddenly not so ridiculous, given the fact that, I mean, when you look at things like Heller versus DC or really just, you know, read the history of the United States at leading up to the Second Amendment, it's not unreasonable to say that this law or the proposed laws are illegal. And so it's not quite as risque as some of the things, like, as I mentioned before, in Boston and several other major cities in Massachusetts, when marijuana possession was decriminalized but still illegal. Now we have recreational marijuana, so at least within the state it's legal. But they were just, they weren't arresting people because they were giving false names, and so the court was ruling, and they were issuing a bench warrant for Donald Duck, and that's really not helping anybody. And so it's just still illegal. It's still a law, and the police are just are looking the other way when technically crimes are going on, or similar to going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit past a state trooper on the highway. Yeah, they're just going to let you go by. It's not worth pulling you over for that. That's a little bit different than this. Of this, legitimately, the government is saying, no, you can't do that, and so we're not going to participate with that. And it has some valid arguments. It's debatable, but I would still say it's very valid.
Maybe this is what you were talking about when you said debatable, maybe not. But the thing that bothers me about this is that the resolutions that are non-binding is that they are essentially Second Amendment virtue signals. I like that they are saying this, but I would much rather that these be binding resolutions. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a good reason why they aren't. But just if all they're doing is saying and not doing, that's a virtue signal, and that bothers me. But still, it's better that they're saying something than saying nothing at all, or worse, going, yeah, this law is fine.
It's also better than, say, like that town, and I believe it was Georgia, where the local town, or the town government declared that, oh, all houses must have a firearm. Firearm ownership is mandatory within this town. But yeah, nobody cared. Nobody was checking. And so that was absolutely a virtue signal. But I've also got to say, with a map like that, I think there's a little more teeth on it. There is something about the strength in numbers.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully this will change their minds. And there are some minds that need changing, because, not to get too far off into the weeds, there are certain people, it wasn't the governor, but there was somebody who was talking about bringing the National Guard in to enforce this. And there were a lot of people wondering, okay, is this where the boogaloo starts?
Yeah.
And the National Guard commander actually had to issue a statement. He didn't really issue it to the people. He issued it to his troops. And it essentially came down to, look, we haven't been asked to do anything. Mm-hmm. So until the governor tells me to do something, nothing's going on. So just go about your business. Remember that you can talk about politics personally, but if you're doing it in public, don't be in uniform, be professional. And if you have any doubts, just remember the chain of command and call them. Don't listen to what the media says. Listen to your commanding officer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that he had to say something indicates that there are a lot of people who are really worried about this. So, yeah, I'm not a big analyst about this, but and I'd have to check, because, you know, the moment you bring him in, you invoke posse comitatus, and I don't quite remember what they can and can't do, because I'm not a lawyer. But yeah, that would just be bad for everyone all around. And I'm glad that, at least as of this moment, the National Guard is quite content to sit on their rear end and do nothing. Or I guess maintain their day jobs.
Yeah. And also, you have things like the confiscations of guns after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. But that was a situation where it kind of took everyone by surprise. Certainly the people in New Orleans weren't expecting the levees to break. So they might have been expecting a serious storm, but they weren't expecting the level of pandemonium and destruction that happened with that storm. But here in Virginia, boy, everyone's all talking about it. It's all over the internet. There are memes. There are hilarious memes or memes. And
thank you
for Aaron. And And so it's really kind of on the forethought that people are already thinking about this. Is if something goes down, it's not going to catch the people by surprise. It's not going to be what is going on here. So that also raises my interest. And again, I can't analyze it because I don't think anything like that has happened here, at least not anytime recently. So I have a lot of faith that level heads will prevail, just because it just seems like such a bad idea for all parties. That why would you go into that? Why would you enter a game where everybody loses?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, let's hope there are no igloos of any sizes,
big, small, or otherwise.
Moving on. So I mentioned before we were down in the Turks and Caicos Islands, and while I was there, I mean, obviously it's one of those like, where is the Turks and Caicos? You probably don't know where it is either, because there's just
they're in the Caribbean,
yeah, or North Atlantic. There's a debate on where the Caribbean starts. I read somewhere that that Cuba and the Dominican Republic, the North Shore is in the Atlantic Ocean and the South Shore is in the Caribbean, and we were north of Cuba, and that was one of the things that I noted was, oh, we're north of Cuba. And I was thinking back about the interview I had with Dr. Miguel Faria, and he wanted to talk about how he grew up in Cuba during the Cuban Revolution. And it was amazingly interesting. So joining me again is Dr. Miguel Faria, and he is the author of America, Guns, and Freedom. And also, you wrote another book, isn't that correct?
Yes, it's called Cuba in Revolution, Escape from a Lost Paradise. And both of these books are available from Amazon, in case anyone is interested. And Cuba, you know, has very, very interesting lessons for the United States. Most people say, well, you know, it's a Caribbean nation, it's Latin America. That cannot, what happened in Cuba cannot happen here, and so forth. In reality, Cuba was a very prosperous and wealthy nation. The proportion of doctors in Cuba was the same as in Europe. In some cases, the laws in Cuba were quite progressive. The Constitution of 1940 that was passed in Cuba was written with the cooperation of extreme right as well as extreme left, and was basically run by the moderates in both extremes of the political spectrum. And Cuba was doing very, very well until the revolution that brought Fidel and Raul Castro to power in 1959. And my parents, interestingly enough, were part of the revolution. They worked in the underground. There were two major groups. I guess I have to give you some background to understand what happened in Cuba and why there are lessons for the United States. There were two groups fighting to overthrow the dictator Fulgencio Batista, who actually had been elected previously as president by a large majority. But then he made the mistake of coming back and overthrowing the government, and people, the Cubans, will not forgive him for that, even though Cuba was prospering and had one of the highest standard of living in the world. Nevertheless, he had violated the Constitution in 1940, and he would not be forgiven. There were two groups of rebels that began to overthrow Batista right from the beginning, from 1953 on. The Student Revolutionary Directorate, to which my parents belong, because it was made from students at the University of Havana and graduates from the University of Havana. A lot of lawyers, doctors, professors were involved in this movement. Then there was a second movement called the 26th of July Movement of Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, and eventually joined by Che Guevara. And they had many communists within their ranks, beginning with Raul Castro and Che Guevara. So there were two bands of rebels. For reasons that we can only speculate, the American media to love Fidel Castro. And to give them credit, Fidel Castro was a very charismatic individual and gave incredible speeches. He was very knowledgeable. But the American media gave a lot of coverage to that group, the 26th of July movement. And eventually, they prevailed, but not without the assistance of the Revolutionary Directorate. The Revolutionary Directorate fought in my own province of Las Villas province in the center of Cuba in the Escambray Mountains, and also had a very strong underground and urban areas. And my parents were very, very much involved. In fact, the head of the Revolutionary Directorate lived in our house for weeks after having attempted the assassination of Fulgencio Batista. And we sheltered him in our home and eventually got him back into the mountains. That's Fauré Chamoun. And all of this is in my book. Anyway, the Revolutionary Directorate was very anti-communist. They wanted to end corruption. They wanted to reestablish the Constitution of 1940, whereas the 26th of July movement was a card that nobody knew, except many people understood that they were communists in those ranks. So eventually, Fidel Castro prevailed, and the Revolutionary Director said, well, wait a minute here. We fought for a nationalist Cuba and to end corruption and to have free elections. And now you have taken over and you are basically becoming a dictator. And Fidel Castro went to the people in a big speech. He even had a white dove that flew to his shoulder and perching his shoulder as he gave a tremendous speech in which he said, are you telling me that you want arms again? Arms for what? To fight the people of Cuba? You know, and his speech was so strong that basically it just disarmed not only the Revolutionary Directorate, but the people of Cuba. And what happened next is that he formed a militia that went around looking at every province, all the registered firearms. And because Fulgencio Batista, as bad as a dictator as he was, supposedly, now we realize that he was much better than what came afterward. But anyway, he allowed citizens to have firearms, but they needed to be registered. So what the militia did, the communist militia of Fidel and Raul Castro, they went through all these offices, got hold of the registration and the list of the registration of the citizens, and then they went door to door to disarm the population, and they did it very effectively. When they came to our home, my father says, what? You're going to take my guns? I was in the underground. I fought against Fulgencio Batista. And maybe I should leave this interesting aside so that get some of your the audience to purchase this book, and because it's very fascinating. It's almost like a novel. But my father refused, and eventually, let's just say he got his firearms back. But most people were not able to get the firearms back. So he took control, the Castro brothers took control in 1959. By 1961, there was an incredible band of rebels in the Escambray Mountains. The mountains were very close to my hometown. And these were people, if you know the history of Russia and Stalin and the kulaks, Stalin ordered the removal of the, quote, the wealthy peasants, which were not really wealthy. They just owned a little piece of land, the kulaks, and exterminated them to take their lands. Well, the same thing happened in Cuba. And the farmers and the peasants, they refused to go along with this, and they went into the mountains to fight the communists. They were anti-communist guerrillas called alzados, and they were led by members of the Revolutionary Directorate who went back to the hills and became leading the rebels. You can go to Wikipedia and read about this now, but it was not covered at all by the media in this country. It was an incredible war insurgency against the communists, and he hardly had a blip anywhere by the media. Raul Castro himself stated that he lost more military personnel in that war than they did in fighting Batista, which is true. Thousands of communist troops were killed by the peasants, and this was not covered either in Cuba or in the rest of the world. Eventually, the peasants were exterminated. Many of the leaders of the Revolutionary Directorate that I knew as a boy in Cuba were captured and shot. Many of them fought to the last man when they were leading the insurgency. Many of our friends died in that war that was not covered. That war went from 1961 to about 1965. In 1965, the G2, the secret police in Cuba, was on the trail to get my father. In fact, they had put a family member to spy on my dad because they wanted to catch him, because my father had fought in the revolution. My mother was a leader in Descambray Mountain. So they had to have a little bit of proof before he was arrested. And that is when we had to escape. And our escape was successful. We spent 3 months from one Caribbean island to another before we finally made it to the United States. When we made it to the United States, we entered legally. We arranged our papers so that, in fact, when we entered the United States, we were residents of this country. I mentioned that because the illegal immigrants today are out of control. But at the laws of a country that you enter, you should respect. And my father was very conscious of this. And so when we finally entered this country, we were residents of the United States, and I am very proud to be an American. As soon as I lived here 5 years, I became a member, a citizen. And so did my father and mother. They were always very patriotic for this country. And we, of course, regretted that we fought against Fulgencio Batista, because he was a far better man than Fidel and Raul Castro were. And this is a story that has not been told and should be told, because I feel that in this country, we are losing our liberty in an evolutionary fashion. In Cuba, freedom was lost via revolution. We in this country are losing it via evolution, shipped away. And one of the things that is happening is the disarming of the population. That was one of the first things that Fidel Castro did, disarm the people, and disarm the people that were not communists. The communists, of course, after they were proven by being informants, and working with the secret police, then, of course, those people were allowed to be part of the militia. What a perversion of the term, militia. And we're seeing that this is happening here, and it's scary, because a country, a nation that does not trust the people with firearms, they tend to be tyrannical. They tend to put the collective ahead of the individual. And in my book, In Cuban Revolution, I do have a chapter. I cannot stay away from science. Science is very important. And I discuss what happened in the Soviet Union, for example, when genetics was taken over by the state. And it was a disaster for the Soviet Union. And of course, science and medicine was taken over by the Nazis so that they could performed the euthanasia program that began in the Weimar Republic, and then, of course, Hitler took it over and committed genocide. It began with science, supposedly with the use of science, where it really is the perversion of science. In Cuba, one of the areas of scientific endeavor that was taken over by the communists, the same as in Russia, was psychiatry. So that anyone that did not think that socialism was an excellent idea and that it make everybody better and that a new man had not had been forged, a better man that had ever existed because of socialism. If you don't believe that, then there's something wrong with you. You're mentally ill, and you need to put in a mental facility. And I discussed that in that book, how people were put in mental hospitals and given electroshock therapy because they were anti-communist. They did not believe in the wonders of communism. And again, that is a facet of science being used by the state to carry on with their social engineering projects, the political goals that the government wants to institute. And I can see that public health, that brings us back to my new book, how public health has been placed in the hands of the state to disarm the law-abiding citizens. And, you know, when that happens, the people are at the mercy of the state. And if we look at the 20th century, it was a very bloody century. 100 million people were killed by their own governments in peacetime, in the Soviet Union, in Nazi Germany, in China, Cambodia, and Cuba. And the lessons that have to be drawn is, how did this happen? Well, if there is one common denominator, is that the people were disarmed. And usually, it began with registration of firearms, then banning and confiscation, and then the state can do whatever it wants with you. And that is one of the reasons, another reason I wrote the book, America, Guns, and Freedom. And even though the subtitle says, A Journey into Politics and the Public Health and Gun Control Movements, as you can now examine, it's a lot more than that. It covers all the history, philosophy, political science, and the association of these entities, you know, with science and medicine. And what happens is the subjugation of the individual to the state. And Cuba provides excellent lessons for this country.
Wow. I mean, that is both a chilling and personal story. And I mean, it's just, it's heart-wrenching. And I appreciate you coming on the show and talking about that. Again, this is Dr. Miguel Faria, and he wrote America, Guns, and Freedom, and also Cuba in Revolution, Escape from a Lost Paradise. And both of those will be linked in the show notes. I highly advise you to check them out. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Doctor.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
All right, so Weird, you said that you had assembled these based on sort of a theme. What was it that made you decide to play this interview? I mean, it's fascinating. I'm glad I heard it, but how does this tie into the overall theme?
Well, one was actually just because I'd gotten back from the Caribbean. It was just I was thinking about that while I was there. Of the I think the time to play this is now. But also, we just recently celebrated Che Guevara Day.
Celebrated?
I mean, he was a bad man, and when he's the day that celebrates him slipping his mortal coil, I've got no problem with that.
Oh, well, there's a difference between Che Guevara Day or Che Guevara Day and dead Che Guevara Day, and that last one I'm personally okay with.
Yeah. I don't know if there is the only day in celebration for him that I've heard of is the day when he assumed room temperature.
So for people who don't follow my public figure page, there was a bit of a verbal scuffle going on between someone who actually defended Che Guevara, not so much defending him, but he stated that no one could prove that Che was racist and homophobic and that he actually killed gay people. And okay, maybe that's an argument we can have, but when someone comes into the conversation stating, and I'm not making this up, although I'm phrasing it a little more bluntly than he did, but something like how Cuban labor camps are okay because unlike the Nazi death camps, well, they weren't extermination camps, and the people who were forced to labor there were at least paid. And when you start in with that justification, I go, No, I really don't care what else you have to say, because you just said that forced labor is okay, and no. So yeah, there was a bit of a scuffle, and so I was very interested in hearing this story from Dr. Faria, and I was hoping that something would happen in that story which would verify my understanding of things. And you know, he mentioned Che, but he didn't go into great detail.
No,
which is unfortunate, but you know. But well, what can you do?
His book, Cuba in Revolution: Escape from a Lost Paradise, is in the show notes. I haven't had a chance to read it. I'm a little bit behind on my reading. So, but I mean, honestly speaking, his other book is really good. So I'm probably going to end up grabbing it at some point. But yeah, it's in there, and it sounds like he's got some. He definitely teased the story about what his dad said to the government officials who were going to take his guns. And so, I kind of want to buy it just for that story.
Yeah, I definitely want to learn more.
And of course, this also ties in with all the people talking about red flag laws. He mentioned all of the actions that they were taking against people and declaring people mentally ill just because.
And registration leading to confiscation.
Well, registration only leads to confiscation. I mean, I live in Massachusetts. All of my guns are registered. The police never use it. It's not a crime prevention thing. It is simply there for when Mara Healy decides that she's had enough of us, for someone to come and knock on my door. It's tough. That whole bittersweet thing of the, was it right to should we have supported Batista instead of supporting Castro? And it's one of those like, yeah, Batista wasn't really a saint either. I mean, so you just get that tough point where it's just terrible government all around. And it's just, that definitely gives me some feels.
Mm-hmm. So we are coming up to Christmas, and this is the time of year when a lot of gunnies get guns as Christmas presents. And that's good. That's fine. We endorse that. But what happens if you are getting that present and you have a child in the house? Kids and guns. It is a potentially lethal combination, but not when the guns are secured properly and the children are trained. David is here to tell us more about both.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'm going to talk about something more controversial than what I usually cover, kids and guns. If you have kids at home, or kids visit your home, there are certain precautions you need to take at different levels. These precautions fall into several categories. The main ones are safe firearm storage, early introduction to firearms, and proper education and training. Safe storage is possibly the simplest element, so I'll start there. Note, while I said it's the simplest, it doesn't mean it's simple. Preventing unauthorized access to firearms is one of the most important responsibilities of any firearm owner. Regardless of whether that unauthorized person is a burglar, a visitor, another resident, or your child, it's always the gun owner's job to secure their firearms. There are a number of options available for secure firearm storage. For example, you could buy a dedicated gun safe. There are a wide variety available in different sizes with various features and from a number of manufacturers. The downside is that a quality safe is expensive, heavy, and takes up as much or more space as a refrigerator. If you only have a few firearms to secure, you could get a small locking case. Many of these come with steel cables for securing to furniture or an interior element in your car. Some are also TSA approved if you're going to be flying with your firearm. The manufacturer's case that came with the gun may have the ability to accept a lock as well. If it's your home defense handgun, there are quick access lock boxes available as well. Some have tap code or biometric locks in addition to traditional keyed or combination locks. Most new firearms come with an adjustable or flexible hasp lock that runs through the open action of the firearm, rendering it inoperable. These are also available from Project ChildSafe, a program the National Shooting Sports Foundation has been running for 20 years. Trigger locks are an additional option often used in conjunction with some type of storage container. Trigger locks are not viable on every firearm or firearm type. Lever-action rifles are a specific example where trigger locks generally don't work. None of these options are perfect, and the best option for you may well be different than that chosen by someone else. Finally, none of these security methods work if we don't use them and use them consistently. Don't forget about the ammunition. Unless it's your home defense gun, it's recommended that you keep ammunition secured separately from the firearms. If you feel it necessary, you can lock that up as well. Next up is early introduction to firearms. I frequently have parents ask me, what's a good age to introduce my child to guns? There is no one-size-fits-all answer here. It depends on several factors. Most importantly, the maturity level and mental focus of the child. After that is the physical ability to handle the firearm safely, followed closely by the capability of the parent or other chosen adult to pass information on in a way that the child can process. One of the things that can often work is to let the child know that any time they want to look at your guns, all they have to do is ask you. If you set this precedent, make sure you always follow through. This recurring visit to the gun safe is also a good time to reinforce the four rules of safe gun handling. Children follow our example more often than our verbal instructions. The NRA's Eddie Eagle program has been a valuable tool in teaching gun safety to children for over 30 years. Its four precepts of stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up are easy for kids as young as 5 years old to remember and follow. If this program is not offered in your child's school, look into changing that. Another useful element is to reinforce how dangerous guns can be if not handled properly. If you have access to an outdoor range, a gallon jug filled with water and red food coloring can be a vivid example of the destructive power of a firearm. If you're going to try this method, make sure you use an appropriate cartridge. The higher the velocity, the better. Once you get the basics down, further training can follow. Make sure you check your state and local laws regarding minimum age for handling a firearm or any other legal requirements. With that out of the way, you'll need to find a source of training. Operation Blazing Sword has volunteer trainers all across the country. While not all of these trainers will be comfortable instructing a child, it never hurts to ask. Another good place to start may be your state's Youth Hunting License Program. These programs require a hunter safety course that nearly always involves a firearm safety element. Proper early education and training can be provided by parents, friends, certified instructors, either individually or as part of an organization. The most important attributes for an instructor are patience and the ability to explain things in a way a child is more likely to understand. The 4-H program has provided quality youth firearms training for over 100 years. The National Shooting Sports Foundation now runs the firearm training element of the 4-H program. According to the 4-H shooting sports standards, age is less important than maturity, the ability to follow rules, and the motor skills to handle a firearm safely. At the national level, the NRA has their National Youth Shooting Sports Cooperative Program. They offer resources, programs, and training to assist youth organizations such as scout troops, JROTC units, 4-H clubs, commercial summer camps, and more. Your state affiliate of the NRA is also likely to have youth shooting activities. As their skill and interest grows, another source of training and education is Project Appleseed. This program provides history and context in combination with firearm training and shooting events to fulfill their goal of building a nation of riflemen and, as they say on their website, to show that many of the values that our forefathers relied on to win our independence are still very much in demand today. Back in the 1950s, and even later in some places, schools had riflery teams and taught firearm safety as part of their regular curriculum. More recently, there's been a movement to reintroduce that type of safety training back into the school system. Look into where that's going in your state, and if no one has started this process, maybe you could step up and start it yourself. While this is in no way a comprehensive list, you can see that there are many ways to securely store your firearms, safely introduce your children or the children of friends to the shooting sports, and continue training as their interest grows. In the words of Principal Skinner, remember, the children are our future. I've asked our host to include links to some relevant web pages in the show notes. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
You know, just the other day, my daughter came down. I think I might have been editing a show. I don't know what was going on, but she came downstairs and said, "Daddy, can I see my gun?" And I did the, "Absolutely. Yep, here we go." And I was very, very pleased that when I handed it over to her, her finger was off the trigger and she did not point it in anybody's direction. I reminded her because she is small and she is not quite at the age where I trust her to take her to the range. But that time is approaching and I really look forward to it.
I believe you said she's four.
She's six.
Oh, she's six. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. She's very close to being range time.
Yep. No, we just got to get a little bit more maturity and she's got to get interested in it. Right now, she likes that gun is hers. And, mm-hmm. and likes to look at other guns. She specifically wanted to just see her gun and mommy's shotgun.
Okay.
So it's one of those like, yeah, there's mommy's shotgun.
So what is mommy's shotgun?
Mommy has a Beretta Eureka semi-auto.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's not bad. It is a very nice shotgun. She went to a woman on target shoot and they shot trap for a little while and she got the bug bitter real hard. And so, yeah, we spent a lot of time. She hasn't done it in years now, but yeah, we've got a very good sporting clays course at my club. And so, yeah, we were burning some clays for a while.
So, I've got a couple points here to react to this segment and they're kind of disjointed. So I guess I'm just going to do them as bullet points unless you want to discuss one in full. So my parents gave me that same, "You can see your guns anytime you want, just ask," talk when I was about six. And I think I've told the story before. You know, I went in, I saw them, they were heavy, they didn't make sounds, they were boring. And, you know, within about 10 minutes, it was like, okay, can I go play with my toys now? And I don't think I ever asked to see them again. So I'm very much a late bloomer in terms of being a gunny. Regarding high school shooting teams, my brother was on a precision shooting team in the early 1980s. Now, what may be different is the fact that we were on an Army base at the time, and it was an Army high school. So, you know, that probably added something to it. And I don't remember all of the things he did, but there was one sport, and I don't remember the name for it, and it was really strange because I've never seen it anywhere else, but they would get this field gun, it was called, and it looked like a really, really long rifle. And it was so long that it took two people to fire it. You know, naturally, they had the hearing protection, but they would rest the barrel, or I guess in this case, the part of the foregrip or something, on another person's shoulder just to support the weight. And then the shooter would look through iron sights, and they would shoot at something that, it looked like it was on a telephone pole, to be honest, but I was like in single digits. Everything was big to me. I don't know how far away. I don't know how high up it was, but they were aiming far away at this thing really high, and they were shooting at little one-inch cubes that had a little balsa wood skewer sticking through them. And, you know, you were supposed to shoot and knock off that cube, you know, using iron sights at some improbable distance. And I just thought that was really cool. And I've never seen that anywhere else. Have you heard of anything like that?
No, as you were saying that, I'm thinking like, oh, I'm going to get Aaron on that one. I know some obscure ass guns and no, I've never even heard of that, especially given how long it was. I'm wondering if were they black powder? Do you remember like big clouds of white smoke?
It might've been, I don't remember.
Because that's actually where, I mean, when you look at like the Mosin Nagants, especially like a Mosin Nagant beside like an M4, even the 9130, which was the shorter one, or the K98 Mauser, the K is for carabiner. That's the carbine. The thing is huge. That was just the, back then, especially when there was black powder, you needed that much barrel length to make use of all the powder and let all the powder burn up. And now that we've got modern smokeless powder, yeah, no, you're not going to be losing. You're going to lose a little bit of velocity, but the round's going to do just fine. So I was wondering if it was black powder with that huge barrel.
It could very well be. I don't remember because I was literally in single digits at the time.
Well, thankfully, we've got Wicked Smat listeners. And so the Wicked Smat listeners will let us know, because I guarantee someone that is hearing this right now has been like, oh, yeah, no, I used to do that. Or I know someone who did that. Or I saw an old photo in a magazine somewhere of people doing that. I know what that's called.
Yeah, please. I want to know what it's called so I can look it up and watch some videos. That would be a really cool way to reconnect.
Screw that. I want to do it.
I would want to do it too, but my vision is so poor that I wouldn't be able to hit anything. I'm
starting to get to that level, unfortunately. I'm definitely noticing that it's starting to get a little bit worse.
And so the final thing I wanted to say, for those of us who are budget conscious or don't have room for a safe, and I'm both, I get by with something I ordered from Amazon. It's called the Stack-On Security Cabinet, and I bought it for about $100 because I think there was some special. It's normally like, I don't know, $115 or $120, and it's really just a lockable steel locker. I mean, it's obviously not a safe. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty good gauge steel, and it's heavy enough, and if you've got the right screws, you can screw it to a wall, to a floor, and you know it won't stop a determined thief, because honestly, nothing will, but you know it's tall, and it's heavy, and it's in my closet, and so that will definitely deter casual thieves, the one who would just break in, grab something, get out. I mean, you would have to like drill this thing out, or have a bunch of people to, you know, muscle it open or something like that. And of course, that means it's good against any curious kids who might accidentally wander into my room. It's not a solution that is better than a safe, but it is a solution. And if you can't afford a safe, this might be what you need.
Yeah, there's levels of security of the what are you doing with that? Are you trying to keep thieves out? And I would actually argue that once the thieves are in my house, like you done screwed up. So most of my security measures are keeping the thieves outside from me having a security system and the little stickers on all the windows so that they know, hey, this house has got an alarm. Yeah, maybe you could defeat that, but maybe you can also go to one of my neighbors who doesn't have one of those and deal with them. And I love all my neighbors, and actually a lot of them have security systems. So I want to be a higher fruit, not a low hanging fruit. And so there's that, you know, put good locks on your system, put good doors. You know, there's a few things that actually, I think I want to harden a few things on the outside of my house that I will not discuss here just for, you know, the sake of OPSEC, but, there's a couple of really good ideas out there to make it so that it is much more difficult to get into your house. And so that is an option so that once they're there, cause again, like you said, all security systems are rated like in hours that people could get through and the given enough time. I mean, I do lock sports, so I pick locks, and it's one of those things of the, all right, look, if given enough times, like I'll sit and watch a YouTube video and rake a lock, and given a long enough time frame and enough distraction so I don't get bored, it will eventually open no matter what my skill level is. But that's not something that I would do if I was nervous about being discovered. Again, everything's rated on levels of time. I mean, you can sit there with an oxyacetylene torch and cut through, you know, most safes. You're going to get through eventually. Honestly speaking, my biggest concern is my daughter and her friends and people around my house. And also at the same time, yeah, no one is in any of the rooms that I keep guns unsupervised. It's just not appropriate. Not going to happen. You know, what are you doing down here? No, this is not where we're having fun. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP Feld tracks, and the ACP Mag Dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network. And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He was sipping rum while the snow came down. And I live in Florida, where it just never snows at all. Our snow shoveling options are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.